Esther 2, verses 18 through 20. Esther chapter 2, verses 18 to 20. Then the king made a great feast unto all his princes and his servants, even Esther's feast. And he made a release to the provinces and gave gifts according to the state of the king. And when the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai sat in the king's gate. Esther had not yet showed her kindred nor her people, as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther did the commandment of Mordecai, like as when she was brought up with him. As I've said a number of times, Esther is a book about providence. And we've heard in the last few verses that Esther's turn had come. This was language meant to imply that things don't fall out merely by chance or luck, but rather these are words that indicate the secret purpose of God that's being unfolded. Solomon in Ecclesiastes 3 says, "To everything there is a season and a time, to every purpose under the heaven." The idea there is that God's season and time to every purpose is displayed in Esther's turn coming. The preparations were made, but not by Esther. If we think about the history of Esther, what we know from being orphaned as a child to being raised by Mordecai, from being taken in the search for beautiful virgin girls, to her entrance at that precise time into the king's palace, everything about this story can be seen as a hand of divine providence. There's divine purpose, a succession of turns. Everything, to everything, there is a season and a time, to every purpose under heaven, every turn. Now, in that Esther required nothing of her own, we saw that Esther was adorned with something which surpassed any of her competitors. She was very clearly, contrary to some who suggest that there might be some defect in her character, she is someone who sought first the kingdom of God. She was a woman by every accounting here, a woman of a discreet and modest spirit. She's very different. And while the hearts of the other women who were, or they thought at least, they were her competitors, while they were set upon the pleasures of this life, while they were putting all of their hopes upon getting into the king's palace and making their big debut and perhaps getting a shot at stardom, Esther was quietly waiting on the Lord. And we're reminded of her upbringing by Mordecai. We are told again and again about his paternal influence as her guardian. Clearly, this has been a very instrumental force, as shall be emphasized in the verses before us. The author of the book of Esther has also emphasized Esther's favor before others. Wherever she goes, it seems, everyone notices her in a good way. What they notice is not the kind of noticing that men make of women in sinful ways, but they notice something wholesome and decent about her. Now, this is not so much something that men are able to instill in themselves, and certainly Esther did not instill this in herself. Favor is from the Lord. And yet, as Solomon reminds us, that favor that is from the Lord comes about in a very certain manner. Proverbs 3, Solomon says, "My son, forget not my law, but let thine heart keep my commandments. For length of days and long life and peace shall they add to thee. Let not mercy and truth forsake thee. Bind them about thy neck, write them upon the table of thine heart." So shalt thou find favor and good understanding in the sight of God and man. Trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. You see, favor then, according to Solomon, favor is a result of the Spirit of God working in the children of God, that new obedience to the commandments of God. Or as Jesus said, if we love him, we'll keep his commandments. And of course, we know that we only love him because he first loved us. And so this favor that we see from Esther, this favor is really the crowning of divine favor upon a life that demonstrates the obedience of the saints. So I think anyone who would accuse Esther of trimming or doing something less than necessary or perhaps even questionable in her walk here is missing the point. Now, as I mentioned last time, Esther comes before the king in the month Tebeth, which was the very month, some 170 or 140 years or so before, when Nebuchadnezzar laid siege to Jerusalem. The verse notes this is the 10th month, and we know that it was on the 10th day of the 10th month that the Jews actually held a fast day commemorating the siege. So this is all going to call attention to the knowing reader to this fact. In this end, the Jews saw a rising of the hopes of the Jewish people and the beginning of the work that would complete the temple. And finally, previously, I asserted that when God commands by voice from heaven or voice of a true prophet, and then goes on to confirm an approval of what we might take to be some otherwise immoral acts or actions among his people, that what we have is an extended type or allegory that reveals something to us of Christ. So in the verse previous to those before us, we're told that the king set the royal crown upon the head of Esther. She was obviously queen. Now, there might be here a seeming redundancy, but this seeming redundancy indicates that there had been a complete changeover of the entire government with the ascension of Esther to the throne. The relation, I think, then, which is held forth here, is actually descriptive of the change that occurs when the magistrate of a nation embraces a chaste spouse of Christ, the church, so as to be married to her. With the rise of Esther, then, what we're about to see is what happens when heathen nations embrace the true religion. When the enemies of the people of God fall from favor, and the people of God are brought to favor through the embrace of true religion by the king. And this truth is taught under the guise of a marriage, because a marriage is a covenant between two parties. When Ahasuerus married Esther, he entered into a covenant with God, who was already in covenant with Esther. This, then, is a story which shall teach us much about the result of national covenanting and national religion and the establishing of the true church to be the queen in the state. So, verse 18. Then the king made a great feast unto all his princes and his servants, even Esther's feast, and he made a release to the provinces and gave gifts according to the state of the king. And the king made a great feast. We're told here is a great feast, a wedding feast. And with this feast, the making of Esther queen comes full circle to where the drama had actually begun. There had been, if you remember, a feast, then a queen who refused the royal crown, and then deposition from the throne. But now what we see is elevation to the throne, acceptance of the royal crown, and a great feast. The king, we know from the account, is actually quite pleased with his selection. And like all of the important and significant decisions which are made in the Persian Empire, it's going to be accompanied with feasting. In fact, at every turn throughout the Book of Esther, every major event in the Book of Esther seems to call forth a feast. Now, feasting in itself is not wrong. It can be done with heathenish abandon, as in the earlier feasting which was recorded. And, of course, that led to the disastrous results that we know from profane history, the bad military advice that Xerxes got, as well as what the Book of Esther tells us, the removal of Vashti as queen. On the other hand, believers are called to times of thanksgiving to be attended with feasting, as providence occasionally calls forth. So Nehemiah 12:43, also that day, and that day is called a day of thanksgiving in Nehemiah 11:17. That day they offered great sacrifices and rejoiced, for God had made them rejoice with great joy. The wives also and the children rejoiced, so that the joy of Jerusalem was heard even afar off. So for the people of God then, feasting can signal the great joy surrounding some received benefit, blessing, or mercy. And of course, as such, those are times when it's most appropriate to vow unto God. Now, what kind of feasting we have here, heathenish or thanksgiving, is really determined by the character of the people and the occasion which calls it forth. And so we're told that the king made a great feast unto all his princes and his servants. This great feast was set, and the king called to it those who had attended his first feast, his princes and his servants. Remember in chapter 1, verse 3, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces being before him. So, the princes were those leaders of those districts, the provinces, the 127 provinces, and the servants were really all of those others who were attending upon the affairs in the palace of Shushan. The difference then is not really the audience, if we understand this. The difference is this. The feast at this point is called a great feast, or a feast of a more exalted kind than the one that was held previously. Now, I want to say that's not necessarily the judgment of Ahasuerus at this point, but it is, in fact, the judgment of the author of our text, who, as I've asserted on a number of occasions, I believe to be Mordecai. It's a great feast. It's a feast that, in fact, portends greater things. The previous feast was a feast that had led to all of the chaos and confusion and casting down in the kingdom. But this feast is attending the elevation of Esther to be queen. For Mordecai and for any other observant and religious Jew, as I've pointed out, the timing of this couldn't have been better. The timing of this looked to them, all of them, like deliverance was at hand. So we're told that this feast was called Esther's Feast. The King James says even Esther's Feast, but you notice the word even is in italics. It's not in the Hebrew. It's just very tersely in the Hebrew, Esther's Feast. This feast, unlike the previous feasts that we've already come across in this, has a specific name. It's given a name. And it's given a name because this feast is a feast held on behalf of Esther. Now, in our narrative, it appears that this banquet is held in the seventh year of the reign of Ahasuerus, sometime not long after the choice of Esther to be queen. The Jewish commentators actually at this point see a number of attempts by the king, beginning with calling this feast Esther's Feast, and some of the other things that follow. They think that this was his attempt to discover her lineage. Remember, she still hasn't told him anything about her family. He knows virtually nothing about her other than she's the one. And so he's not really sure what to do. And so the Jewish commentators think that these are all, these and some of the things following are attempts on the part of the king to get to the bottom of this matter and to discover something more about her. Now, I would say this. They say that by throwing this banquet, the king maybe hoped to get her to reveal her family by inviting some of them at least to come and participate. You know, it'd be very unusual to have such a grand celebration and not invite anyone that belongs to your family or close friends, someone that might tip the hand a bit and give him some hint at least as to her lineage. And I would say that the commentary by the Jews, while I don't think it's really throwing direct light on this event, they do actually inadvertently back into what I think is a very important issue, and that's the issue of identity. The reason Esther's lineage is important is to establish identity. And it's important because if you understand anything about identity, identity is not merely something which pertains to individuals, but identity has a corporate dimension. If we remember that the king, by calling this Esther's Feast, continues to denote, as that earlier redundancy about placing the crown upon her head, denotes a change in the constitution of his own government, there are some interesting things to consider. What he seems to be indicating, in all of this at least, is his government is now a government that's going to take in the interest of Esther. And that actually means it's going to have to include the interest of all those who share in her identity, even though he doesn't yet know who or what that might entail. So he made a great feast unto all his princes and his servants, Esther's Feast, and he made a release to the provinces. Literally, the Hebrew doesn't say he made release, it actually says he caused a rest, or as we might term it, a holiday. He decreed a holiday to be made to the provinces. Now, there are some who think that this refers to rest from work. Others think that it speaks of a release from prison. However, I think it almost certainly refers actually to a release from the paying of tribute. It's really a tax holiday. And it's a tax holiday on behalf of the queen. You know, you get time off from paying your tribute or your tax to the king. Now, of this, the Jews thought that the king had actually gone to Esther and said, "Look, if you only tell me who your people are, for them, this tax holiday is going to be permanent." But that's probably not really in view here. Nonetheless, there was the autonomous province that was known to the Persians at this time as Yehud Medinata, the province of Judah, which covered much of the southern territory of the former kingdom of Judah. And so, according to the Jews, they thought that would find tax relief. Of course, they along with all the other 127 provinces together, they all found tax relief at this time as a result of this. And the fact is, although she doesn't reveal it, the Jews, again, swerve into something here because, in a sense, this semi-permanent tax relief, at least this tax holiday would occur not too long after, when Ezra and Nehemiah arrive to build the temple, to continue the building of the temple and the building of the wall around Jerusalem. They're going to get a lot of preferments then. They're going to get a lot of money back. And so you might see that as a kind of tax holiday, or at least certainly a preferment. The purpose of the suspension of tribute, I think, rather was twofold. Right? First of all, the king is doing this to express his great joy. You know, he may have been a great king and had a wonderful, luxurious lifestyle, but the fact is, up until this moment of his life, he'd actually discovered he had no one upon whom to lavish his love. He had no one to love. You know, it probably is the case he didn't really love Vashti. He thought she was beautiful. Thought she was maybe desirable in a number of other ways. But he didn't really have that love. You know, the text earlier indicated that he loved Esther above all women, and that would include Vashti. You know, he had a sense about her that he'd never had before. So this tax holiday is going to be a tangible expression to the entire empire that the king finally has found someone to love. It has a second purpose, though, and that is, beside calling attention to this, it's going to increase regard for the new queen on behalf of whom they experience this relief. Remember, the queening of Esther represents a new era and an adjustment of relations between the Persian sovereign and all the subjugated peoples under his rule. Now, the fact is that tax amnesties, which is really what this was, they weren't uncommon as part of royal weddings in the ancient Near East. There's an example in the record of Pseudo-Smerdis usurping the Persian throne in about 522 BC. And what he does is he actually gives tax release and release from military service for 3 years. So it's not necessarily the tax relief or tax holiday that was uncommon. But what's uncommon is going to follow in the events surrounding the wedding. Because, as I've said, the king will typify the conversion of the nations to Christ and the establishing of the true religion as a national religion, and all by way of his covenanting with her. So he gave tax relief, and we're told beyond that he gave gifts. Instead of the king receiving tribute from the provinces, he actually now is portrayed as sending gifts or portions to them. This, too, notes for the reader, calls attention to the fact that the relationship between the chief magistrate and the people have changed, but especially, if we understand the thrust of the book of Esther, that the relationship between the magistrate and the church has changed radically. You see, a king who is in covenant with the church of God is a king who, without knowing any more, already begins to serve the people rather than demanding that they serve him. He's now demonstrating himself to be a minister of God rather than a beast ravaging the poor people under him. Now, what he's done is he's entered into covenant with the queen. This union has begun to bring peace and prosperity to those under him. Remember that favor that she had that he recognized? That favor now is shining out of her in her new position upon the entire empire. And gave gifts according to the state of the king. The gifts of the portions he gave were those which, as the Hebrew indicates, befitted the king himself. They're royal endowments on behalf of the queen. They're sent into the various provinces and sent for the benefit of the numerous peoples under his authority and command. These aren't the gifts of the queen to the people. They're the gifts of the king to the people. And yet they are specifically given on the occasion of this covenant with the queen. So as I say, Esther's favor before the king is here reflected in the favor of the king toward his people. It's bringing about a change. You know, people who don't think it's important who you marry or with whom you find yourself in covenant or league, it's very important. It can change all kinds of things about you. It can change you for the better or for the worse. And here we see it's changing this king for the better. So in verse 19, and when the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai sat in the king's gate. Now this verse is a verse which has been troubling to a lot of the commentators. They find it relatively difficult to understand. In fact, the Septuagint has actually just deleted it from the text altogether. There are a lot of these higher critic commentators who think this verse has been inadvertently interpolated into this position, doesn't belong there, so on. All of this, I think, seems to mistake the necessity of this verse to what follows. I think they've just missed the point entirely of why this verse is here. So, and when the virgins were gathered together, it's true, the search for the queen had ended. The king had been, in a sense, converted by her. But the problem is, the king yet himself remained unconverted by God. And so though he took delight in her, and though she had found favor in his sight, the fact is, as of yet, the king himself had not found favor with the Lord. What he had done may have found favor with the Lord, but the king himself had not yet come to that point. And so the point of this verse is to let us know that the influence of the queen for good was almost immediately eclipsed because his heart really wasn't in it. So her new power of influence quickly began to wane. And we know this because we're told here the king returned to his search to fulfill his own lust. The harem is going to continue to grow. And at least for a moment, if we were to stop on this verse, we might seem to think at least that the influence of Esther is going to go away. It's going to continue to fade away from our view. And the problem is that without genuine conversion, the king is actually left to wonder if he might find some sort of similar bearing in some other woman. He doesn't really know what it is to be a true believer himself. And so he's not sure if he really has put his finger on what it is. And since he doesn't really know what it is that he finds so endearing, so attractive, so favorable in Esther, he wonders. Because without genuine conversion to God, he's got to struggle to come to assurance that his rest and confidence in Esther was well placed at all. It's very easy to begin to second guess, right? What if there was someone better out there? You know, what if I stopped too soon? And what if he had missed the thing he found so engaging in another? You know, maybe he just didn't notice it before, but now he would be on the lookout for this particular thing. Maybe he can pin it down. If he can just find it in someone else, he can figure out what it is. Some of the virgins were gathered together the second time. What this clause indicates is this was a second go-around in the retinue of virgins who would be fit to become concubines. The cycling and trafficking in human flesh was much like the first time around, except this time, of course, we know there's going to be no Esther in this group. Right? And so this represents all of the searching, not a rehashing of those already concubines, but all of the searching, because these these wouldn't be described as virgins, but merely as women, if he were just going over the house of the concubines. Now, the Jews on this actually maintain that Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, was gathering this second group of virgins together in order to excite in Esther some kind of jealousy, again, in order to move her to declare to him her kindred or her people. Now, they're fixated on that idea. Of course, I would just say it supposes the king had no other reason to search for anything beyond the reception of Esther, when clearly an unconverted man is still searching. He just doesn't know. This also gives us a time frame, because we're told that when the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai sat. And this is important, right? Because at this time, while the second gathering is taking place, Mordecai, now we understand, has been brought to occupy a very different situation in the kingdom. Prior to this, we saw him, he was walking, as it were, to and fro before the house of the women, waiting to get or catch hold of any piece of information he could regarding the fate of Esther. But now, we're told that he's sitting. In Hebrew, the word sit, it can refer to dwelling in a place, and it certainly indicates that he has come to dwell more securely in the area of Shushan, the palace. But I think more to the point, in this place, what it indicates is that Esther has in some way influenced the king, so that Mordecai has come to a position of some type of authority. He's received his own enthronement of sorts. So with Esther's advancement to honor, that is, with the church's establishment by the king, or at least the preference of the true church by the king, the righteous are made to be favored in the affairs of the state. Because we're told that Mordecai sat in the king's gate. He's sitting in the king's gate. That term gate, and the gate is where the judges sat. The gate is where those who decided in disputed matters in any kind of city, ancient city, would sit. You would bring your matters before those who sat at the gate. Well, he's not just sitting at any gate. We're told he's sitting at the gate of the king. So Mordecai has been promoted to being some kind of officer in the king's court. Now, although the king himself doesn't yet know the lineage of the queen, that is to say, although he doesn't yet believe for himself, yet he is moved by the influence of the queen to have Mordecai occupy a place of power and trust. Isn't that interesting? You see, the king can see some value in the church, but he's not yet a member of the church by faith. So with that, he also perceives value in having those who are prophets or teachers in the church informing and instructing him in his court. And he's getting that. It's shadowy, but he's getting that. And it's from this position that Mordecai will become aware of information that will itself transform the king's reign and bring Esther into greater prominence again. Because it's from this position that Mordecai will be able to support and protect the queen from the enemies of God's people. This verse then explains to us how Mordecai actually has the opportunity to gain the knowledge of the plot that we will be discussing, Lord willing, next time in the verses which follow, as well as explaining to us the close proximity he has to the queen so that he can inform her of it and also care for her personal protection in all of this. So in verse 20, Esther had not yet showed her kindred nor her people, as Mordecai charged her. For Esther did the commandment of Mordecai like as when she was brought up with him. Esther had not yet showed her kindred or her people. Now here again, we're told in the narrative that Esther had remained quiet on the question of the identity of her lineage. And that is an important point. The verse places emphasis, in fact, upon her kindred, her descent, before her race or her people. Because the main question, at least at this point that's being raised, has to do with her relation to Mordecai sitting in the gate. And why is that so important? Well, had her lineage been clearly discerned at this point, that is, had anyone known that Mordecai was her uncle, the plotters in the following verses probably wouldn't have been inclined to speak their mind anywhere near this guy. They would have kept him from getting the information that he's going to need to set the stage for the deliverance of the people of God. And so at least one reason for concealing this kindred question has to do with concealing her relation to Mordecai, so that no one really yet knows that these two are uncle and niece. Now, the king knew that he found her supremely attractive, and she, in turn, had found favor in his sight. But the fact is, her origins were still obscure to him. He didn't probably even know that she was a Jew, a member of the true religion. But I think very clearly what he must have understood from her very demeanor was that she was a religious person. And she's going through and she's keeping a lot of rituals that probably were a bit of a cipher to him. He didn't understand them. It was somewhat mysterious. More importantly, as I say, the connection between Mordecai and Esther, that remains unrevealed. So all of the actions of the king in favor of the queen are simply because he perceives in her something of great worth and value. What he's like here is he's like a magistrate who actually perceives some value in having a Christian population without himself being moved by faith itself. And that, I would suggest, was a position of a lot of the early presidents in the United States. You know, they at least perceived that they needed a Christian people, that the Constitution would be, in fact, untenable without a majority Christian population who would be self-governing. But anyway, Esther had not brought the testimony of the gospel before the king because the time was not yet ripe. She had not yet showed her kindred or her people as Mordecai charged her. Now look at the emphasis here. It shows Esther continues to honor her historic lineage and connection to Mordecai. Being queen doesn't change her relation to Mordecai. She arrived at that point and actually become queen precisely by following his instruction. She did no more, she did no less. Now, having been advanced to a position of power and trust, that didn't lessen her sense of obligation to do as Mordecai had charged, or as the word means, as he had commanded her to do. And Mordecai, as I've said, he's a true prophet. He's a true teacher in Israel. And he's positioned to help her understand the times and the seasons. She doesn't rest then upon her own wisdom. But she rests on the appointed means that God has established. He had given her Mordecai, both for a father and for a teacher. The point is that true ministry is that which establishes paternal authority. It doesn't undermine it. It doesn't cut away lineal descent. For Esther did the commandment of Mordecai. Now, this clause, the emphasis is now on the commandment of Mordecai. And this, actually, the commandment of Mordecai comes first in Hebrew. It's really the commandment of Mordecai, Esther did. It's notable, I think, the word translated commandment here is a different one from the word in the previous clause. the previous clause used the word most naturally understood as commandment. The word that's used here, though, is a very interesting word. It's derived from a root word that has to do with wedding speech or a formula of betrothal. What it means is something more like this. It's to instruct, but the instruction is in the context of a betrothal or a wedding. It's instruction in a covenantal context. So Esther, now Queen Esther, she continues, we are led to understand, to receive covenantal instruction from Mordecai. That is to say, Esther, although enthroned, remains faithful to the cause of God and his truth as taught by the true teacher or prophet of God. The fact is, the king might be over here wavering in his commitment to Esther, but we're assured in this verse that Esther's commitment to the faith is certain. For Esther did the commandment of Mordecai like as when she was brought up with him. The filial nature of Esther's obedience is held forth now as being exemplary. Her childlike disposition to receive the truth of God from the hand of her father prophet is significant. Now, this is going to help us to understand the actions of the queen as she, with the direction and guidance of Mordecai, seeks to bring the true religion established into living practice and application both in the palace of Shushan and throughout the whole empire. Now, she might have been tempted to cast off the restraint of true religion, to make compromising decisions within the current palace and courtiers. But this, importantly for the people of God scattered throughout the empire, is not to be the case. Esther knows, she knows without any shadow of doubt, that her security as the established queen is only to be found in the wisdom of true religion and the patient submission to the working of divine providence. You know, patient submission to providence without the wisdom of true religion often will make men to acquiesce in present evil without any concern for reform. But the wisdom of true religion without a patient submission to the work of providence often makes men fanatics who trample lesser commands in order to carry out the weightier matters of the law, which is contrary to what Jesus says. But woe unto you, Pharisees, for you tithe mint and rue and all manner of herbs and pass over judgment and the love of God. These you ought to have done, and not to leave the other undone. Observe then the action of the king. Having picked and married a queen, he desires to make displays of his love for her. And he doesn't do this by moving displays of affection, which are properly private, into the public light. You know, he doesn't get all lovey-dovey with her on some balcony somewhere. Instead, he displays his affection in a very appropriate way by doing things in her honor. This was a time when men were men, and they understood true love, not just this feminine romantic desire for personal attention, but true love would move them to do things for others. First, for the one beloved, and then for those extended family and friends. Now, the case is that until the 19th century turned marital love into romance fiction, only fit for depraved effeminacy, men and women married with considerations which were much broader than just themselves. They thought about this proposition in terms of how it would impact whole families, and if they were rulers, in fact, an entire kingdom. In the case of this king, his choice is one which has consequences, very serious consequences, for the whole of his empire. And so it's therefore quite fitting for such a sovereign to allow the benevolence of his love to find at display amongst the people under his rule. He's going to let it show. He's going to let people know that he does care for her. But he's not going to do it in the ways that, you know, tabloids and modern sensibilities are seeking. The king has sense, not sensibility. Now, this all fell out, we're told, in an orderly fashion, which, in contrast to earlier events recorded in the book, show that whatever is inordinate in the whole affair has been subjected to a larger concern. Love has covered a multitude of sins. Right? It's covered over a lot of what's going on here. There's much more going on, perhaps, than first meets the eye. Yes, there's been a lot that's been inordinate, but when it comes to the matter of Esther, what is inordinate has been shielded from our view, and even her going before the king has been given a separate treatment in order to avoid that connection to the sordidness of the whole affair. There's a sordidness to the whole affair. But here there's an orderliness. And it goes like this. First, the princes or the satraps, and then those who are servants. Now, why are they mentioned when he brings about this great feast? Why are they mentioned first? Well, think of this. A change in disposition on the part of the king is going to have an immediate and direct effect on those who are closest to the throne. Those princes, those satraps, they've been involved in that debacle that had ended in military defeat before Greece. And they had given him that horrible counsel with respect to Vashti. The servants, particularly his private servants, those who had tended to his daily needs, they're going to be very happy with his newfound contentment. After all, they're the ones who had given him that counsel to seek another queen. So a change in kingly countenance from him, that's going to mean a great deal to them. And no longer are they going to be tending on a guy who in his private chamber is continually sad and downcast. There's a guy who is now going to be much more content and happy with his life. It's going to have an effect. It's going to have an effect on all of them. Now, second, there's this expressed concern and solidarity in this with the people that he has all throughout the empire. So tax release, military release, whatever, all of this served to assure the people that the king's change in countenance is to be felt everywhere he reigns. He's going to make it felt everywhere. And while the rest or the holiday from royal impressments would give a general sense of this newfound joy in the life of the king, sending gifts or portions actually helps to make this public display of his affection for the queen felt quite personally. I want you to remember that what we're seeing here, what we're being given is a glimpse of that which transpires when a nation comes to adopt the principles of true religion. When the principles of true religion in the person of the church are brought into covenantal relation to the magistrate. Now, let me emphasize, as James Renick famously said, a magistrate is a magistrate as a man, not as a Christian. Nonetheless, as covenanters, what we know and confess is that a magistrate really cannot serve God aright without the entrance of special revelation. And we see this in the case of Ahasuerus or Xerxes. There is a debacle in state, public affairs, that military disaster that we know of from Herodotus' account. And there is that domestic debacle that we know of from the account in Esther. But now all of this has changed. The king has come into a covenant with Esther. She's the queen. And we understand from this the king is now, at least in some sense, striving to honor her by honoring the covenant that he's made with her. And that's a start. Now, I think most importantly here, it's necessary to point out no believer has been compromised in this endeavor. No one has had to do anything, no believer has had to do anything that would break the law of God or that would undermine their testimony within the Empire of Persia in order to come to power. So, for example, none of them had to vote to bring about this change. There's no voting going on here. Couldn't vote at that time if you wanted to, but they certainly were not voting. They weren't in any way taking upon themselves the duty of executing an ungodly constitution. None of them then had to engage in political action or activity that involved any kind of forbidden alliances or voluntary associations with the wicked. None of them are tainted with those sorts of things. Everything that transpires in the book of Esther comes to pass by the methodical working of divine providence in accordance with prayers of the saints. They're not reliant on anything else. Now again, as I've noted, the king is not himself a saved man. In fact, he displays the failings of one who has only heard tell of the truth but doesn't yet believe it himself. And he knows it's out there. He's heard somewhat of it, perhaps. He certainly has seen the effects of it in Esther. And he knows that there's something there. He knows that there's something that is desirable. And evidently, he also perceives something valuable to the governing of the empire. After all, why would he choose her to be queen when he had all those other choices? Right now, King Ahasuerus is being led, in a sense, in a way that he knows not. He's being led down a path of which he himself has no personal knowledge. He doesn't know which way to go or even when to stop. In a sense, I think he's kind of like those people that we read of in Samaria who had heard tell of Jesus through what I think we can describe as the preaching of the Samaritan woman. After all, she is a picture of the church in some degree, the Gentile church. John 4:39, and many of the Samaritans of that city believed on him for the saying of the woman, which testified, "He told me all that ever I did." That sounds a lot like what's going on here with King Ahasuerus. Doesn't sound like the Persian king believes on God for himself, but he's believing on God for the saying of the woman Esther. He's got a sense from her, but he's still not there himself. This is only preliminary then to true faith. Because the point of bearing testimony, as Esther is, and as that Samaritan woman did, the point of bearing testimony is that some of those who respond to that testimony will come to true and saving faith. And so in John 4, verses 40 to 42, when the Samaritans were come unto him, that is to Jesus, they besought him that he would tarry with them, and he abode there 2 days. And many more believed because of his own word. and said unto the woman, Now we believe, not because of thy saying, for we have heard him ourselves and know that this is indeed the Christ, the Savior of the world. In other words, when the king finally hears with the hearing of faith, he's going to act from a very different impulse and with a much more pointed endeavoring to advance the true religion. Remember the case of Nebuchadnezzar before and after his time as a beast. He had one attitude toward the true God going in and another attitude toward the true God at the end of it all. A very similar thing we're going to see happen here with this king. For now, however, he takes account of the recent events and he has to begin to wonder what exactly attracted him to Esther versus those other virgins that were brought in. Now, in order to answer that, what he does is he gives rein to his lust and he sets up an unlawful way of gaining answer to this question of his by resuming the stream of women into his harem. Remember this. Believing on account of another is not going to keep you in the day of temptation. Not going to be enough to hold you back. So it's important, it's even imperative that you believe on Jesus because you've heard him for yourself. And this is what he has to say. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. You can't rest upon the promise of any other, but upon his alone. Now I want to note as well that when kings are reconciled to the church, even if they're not reconciled to God themselves, the fact is that they'll display much less antagonism toward the people who belong to the church. So with the elevation of Esther, though he still knows nothing of the historic testimony of Esther, the story, that is, of the gospel in the history of the Jews, yet it's quite apparent here that he is well disposed to a true prophet of God. Because now we're told that Mordecai sits in the king's gate. Now he occupies a position, a place of power and trust, and that by the will of the king. Again, he didn't get here by his own political endeavoring. It was not by his own conniving at this. Mordecai's name appeared on no ballot. Mordecai didn't even court the reins of power. Mordecai does not assume this position by subjecting himself to any ungodly oaths or vows in order to accomplish this. The fact is, in God's time, in God's set time, Christ shall arise with healing in his wings, and Zion shall be restored. It's not by might, it's not by power, but it's by the Spirit of the Lord. Finally, I want you to think about Esther. Remember Esther and her simple obedience to the command and instruction which Mordecai gives her. At every point, Esther is submissive to the words of the true prophet of God. At every point, Esther does what she is told. She is, in her person, a faithful church. She doesn't repine or recoil at the words of the prophet of God. She doesn't find his instruction to be instruction that is too difficult to carry through. She's not embarrassed. She's not put off. She's not afraid. She's not distressed. She's simply obedient. She's a faithful daughter of Mordecai, and more importantly, she's a faithful daughter of the true religion. And in this, as I said, Esther is a picture then of the faithful church enthroned by covenant among the kingdoms of the heathen Gentiles. A number of weeks ago, I pointed out that this is a love story between God and his people, between Christ and his church. Nonetheless, it's the reception of the truth as it is in Jesus that makes what is unlovely lovely, and what makes the church faithful and historical together at once. After all, we're told again and again that Esther was the daughter of Abihail and Mordecai. Her lineage is presented to us as both natural and spiritual. And without both, there would be no further point in this story of Esther. Amen.